Hello, everyone. Max Forte here with another Max Forte Chat episode. Today, we're going to talk to Dominik Hoch. He is an incredible source of essentials, extracts, industry compounds. They've worked for years in the industry, over 30 years. Used to be the head of sourcing for Firmenich, which you guys know is one of the head companies for compounds. So welcome to the chat, Dominik Hoch.
Thank you very much, Max. Very nice to join you.
Pleasure to have you with us. So before we get started, because I know the fragrance community, whilst very big, you know, enormous all over the world, sometimes we miss the things that we should know about. And I was talking to you before we started the recording. I myself was not aware of you and what you do, which is incredible. So let's start off with who you are and what you do, please, if you could.
Okay, thank you very much for the introduction. I'll try to keep this simple. What I've been doing over a little more than three decades is basically go and search for and secure the natural raw ingredients that are used to craft the final blends of the perfumes. So everybody will be very familiar with some of them, not to name, you know, lavender, rose oil, patchouli. And some of them are not quite as well known. So the thing is about this job is that it used to be called being a purchaser, basically, because that's what you do. You go to Bulgaria because the perfumers in the company that you're working for are in need of these products, and you have to secure, of course, the best quality, et cetera, et cetera. And as time passed, the job itself has changed quite a lot. And today we would refer more to it as a job of sourcing, sourcer, rather than purchaser, which means that this will not be a surprise for anyone. To the strict business aspect of the job, a lot of things have been added around which country will I choose to do my sourcing to, with which people am I going to work? How do I select them? With which criteria? How do I make sure that what I'm doing is also doing good for the communities that are at the source, that cultivate the fields, that tap the trees, et cetera, et cetera? So there's what I've been trying to do in my book is tell how these things have incredibly changed over the past, let's say, 10 years max, and how maybe a job that was a little bit too narrowly defined, it's gotten to change into something that can really bring passion to what you do.
Amazing. And just, I want to obviously let people know about your book because it's a great riveting book that has incredible stories of sourcing of natural ingredients and materials. So you can actually go to Amazon right now, and the book is called In Search of Perfumes, A Lifetime Journey to the Source of Nature's Scents, which is free right now to download the Audible version at Amazon.com. And this is not a sponsored podcast by Amazon by any means, but I just wanted to let you know that this is a great book to start to get to know about sourcing, sustainability, and harvesting and so forth and so on, which, by the way, me and Dominik had the pleasure to join Amouage in the sourcing of rose, the rose that they utilize to make these beautiful oils for the fragrance that they produce. We were able to experience that incredible adventure in Oman, as well as look at some Omani frankincense, trees, which was amazing. So tell us a little bit about your story, Dominik, and how this job found you. You know, how did the journey begin? When did you, because 30 years, let's go back 30 years now before you started. What made you passionate about this journey, and why did you take this path?
Yeah, let me just try to explain that what happened to me is a little bit the opposite of what usually the road that people take when they join the perfume industry. Usually you will start as a chemist or as an analyst or as a perfumer, if you can, meaning that you'll start very close to the final product in the labs. What happened to me by a series of meetings and changes after studying business, I met some people and I happened to find some French company was just starting at the time who wanted to distillate pine needles. So you're completely on the other side of our perfume business, where some people start and want to do the raw material. So these people were hoping that distilling pine oil would bring them successfully in this business, which proved very difficult because this is another thing, you know, about the raw materials. Some are very precious, others are less, some are appreciated, others less. Anyway, so I started like that, and these people decided, they were pretty, were in 87 or 88, and they were the first to understand that if you wanted to be credible in the future in terms of raw materials, you had to be as close as possible to the source where the products really grow, where they happen. So the first project we had for a company that had big needs in cistus and labdanum derivatives was to go to Spain, to go to southern Spain in Andalusia, and build out of nothing a distillery and an extraction facility to create a whole range of labdanum derivatives. So I dedicated myself to this, learned Spanish, and learned to understand what was going on with the cistus at the time. And I'm telling this story in my book because it was the magical encounter with the Roma people. At the time, we called them the gypsies. Now they're more the Roma people who were really boiling the gum in an incredibly primitive and traditional way. And we started working with them and seeing how we could have the things progress and develop and do distillation and extraction. So one factory, then another. I went to Bulgaria, did the same thing with rose, bought a factory, planted rose fields, did the same in Turkey, went to Morocco for other products like orange flower. Finally went to Madagascar for the famous vanilla and the ylang ylang. So within 10 or 15 years, and a bit like not really realizing it, I sort of became an expert in these things where usually people, you know, it's very far from them, so they're not very familiar. And what I did in the following years, which was really incredibly interesting, was thinking about the way, how do you link a Roma worker that knows nothing about the final perfume with a fantastic master perfumer who is completely in a different world in New York or in Geneva, but who understands the magic and the subtlety of a labdanum derivative. And this is what I've been really working, connecting what is happening at the community level with what is happening in the most incredibly high-level fine fragrance studios.
This is incredible work. So basically, you're facilitating, you're bridging the gap. You're connecting the perfumers with the source. That's incredible work. And you've been doing this for 30 years. Now, let's talk about some of the intricacies and some of the maybe fun facts that you want to share with us through your, you know, history of 30 plus years doing this, you know, going to these countries. You know, tell us maybe some of the most challenging, you know, facts you found within harvesting or the production of some of these compounds. If you can share some stories or some fun facts in your findings.
Yeah, of course, there's many stories. I think looking back, what is very striking is that some of our products come from countries that are so deep into poverty that it makes the whole thing very difficult. I'm thinking here especially to Madagascar and Haiti. Haiti is the great country, of course, for the vetiver oil, and it's an amazingly poor and completely how should I say that? It's the whole country is a wreckage. Of course, they have you know, suffered from the terrible earthquake and many things. But as a whole, you know, Haiti is simply going through a dark tunnel constantly. And Madagascar is exactly the same. We're talking here of countries that have no government. When they have governments, the governments don't care about the people. You go to Madagascar, you're looking for vanilla, and you start to realize that the people doing this are living in conditions that are basically unchanged for the past 100 years. They're living in little shacks, wooden shacks. The only thing they have now is a telephone, but they still have usually no access to drinkable water. They have absolutely no medical care. They have to walk for miles. You know, the children, if they want to go to school, if they're lucky enough to have a school in the neighborhood, etc. So I think a lot of the people who listen to us will be familiar with these realities. But the thing is, discovering this as a tourist is one thing. Discovering it and trying to do business raises another series of questions. You know, and here comes something that has been so important in everything I've done is who do you meet at source that you can trust and with whom you can handle this type of problems that I'm mentioning? And if people read the book, they will discover a woman in Madagascar called Gigi, who was, a little child, completely one of these very, very poor families, and who gradually, just by her work, became one of the main, most important exporters of vanilla in Madagascar, was very successful, and never, ever forgot where she was coming from. And with Gigi, we spent so much time trying to see, you know, what smart things could be done in those remote areas for those people. And this is really where you have the sense that if you do things the right way, then business, instead of being a burden or exploiting the people, can really help them and can contribute to, you know, sort of take them out of the first level of poverty. So that's Haiti and Madagascar are very, very strong memories. Then you get to different types of emotions where it's the product itself that is completely magical. Here I'm thinking immediately of two of them coming from trees. One is the benzoin in Laos. Incredible. You go to the northern Laos, you're completely lost in very remote villages. And here you have this guy who taught the villagers how to grow the benzoin trees, how to handle them, how to tap them, to make sure they don't die. And you can see how this guy has completely revived a tradition that was very old, but that could have perfectly disappeared, because always they're the threat on this very, very fragile natural products. So the memories of Laos are beautiful because the benzoin resin is something with its vanilla smell is something absolutely marvelous. And another one, which is extremely well known now, is the oud, the famous agar wood. And again, it's this mysterious tree in a lot of countries from Southeast Asia, where you have to be a super expert to just looking at the tree, guess whether the treasure that might be inside, which means the white wood having turned into pieces of dark wood loaded with resin, if it's worth cutting the tree and trying to find them. So these were adventures I had the luck to be part of in Bangladesh, another very difficult country. And absolutely amazing, because the smell of burning pieces of wood on embers is one of the strongest smell that one can experience. It's something that you could really call it, you know, like a drug, except it just brings you happiness and I don't know, and a whole bunch of emotions, but the power of this smell is incredible.
Amazing. Now, from all the fragrances that you've experienced over the last 30 plus years that you've been in the industry, because I want to get deeper into your taste as well, tell us a little bit about your maybe favorite fragrances over the years, or if you have like a signature fragrance that you like to wear. And then, this is a second part of this question. What do you feel is the next best thing? Because we've seen over the years, at least over the last 10 years, as you said, the market has changed so much. We have these trends like the oud, you know, even though oud's been around for you know, hundreds of thousands of years, over the last, you know, 12 years or so, it's been getting really huge here in this part of the world. So what do you feel is the next best thing, the next upcoming trend? And, you know, over the years, what has been your favorite fragrances to wear yourself?
Okay, so let's take this one by one. I'm in love with Rose, so that's sure. And I don't know in there a lot of people are in love with Rose, although it's very interesting because a lot of people are in love with smelling a rose on the field. Another story is the rose oil, because the rose oil doesn't smell really like a fresh flower, okay? But I've worked so much and I've experienced so much of distilling the flowers, the rose flowers in Bulgaria and Turkey, that I'm completely hooked to that perfume. And I think rose is here to stay. Rose will stay. It's very costly. So a lot of perfumes have sort of discarded over the years using it. But I think in, especially in niche perfumery, in quality perfumery, it's coming back very, very strong and here to stay. In terms of trends, my feeling is that maybe we're going to move a little bit away from gourmand and go more to woody. I would see that. I think there's an appetite for different reasons for the woody notes. First of all, because they materialize a little bit the fact that perfumes have stopped to be strictly feminine or masculine, and that a lot of creators and perfumers are looking for more something that could be worn by both gender. And the woods bring beautiful answers to that, be it the American cedar, which is a juniper, or be it the Gaillac from Paraguay, there's a series, the sandalwood, of course, the magical sandalwood. So I think we haven't seen yet everything that is going to be discovered with using woods in perfumes. And that brings me to my favorite. So I'm wearing a lot Grey Vetiver, which is a Tom Ford perfume, which is not from absolutely yesterday, but which happens to have been created by a good friend of mine, master perfumer Harry Fremont, who's retired in California now. And if he's listening to us, hello, Harry. And Harry is the person who once we sat together and he started talking to me about vetiver and patchouli and what they had in common and how they were different. And he was bringing the warmth, the incredible earthy warmth of the vetiver oil. And as a following, we went together in Haiti. We dug up roots ourselves in the fields. And that was a beautiful experience. And I think he had created the Grey Vetiver at that time already. But as a memory, and because I love it, I still wear it a lot.
It's funny you say that. I would have to agree on the upcoming trends. I see this more and more with new releases, whether it be designer or niche. I see a lot of use of old world, fragrance profiles. I think Chypres, Fougères, Woody, trend is definitely here to stay, especially, a lot of frankincense too. A lot of brands are using frankincense, clary sage. So I can agree with you. I think that that cross of modern meets classic and, gender free, anybody can wear, woody, powerful scents. I think it is definitely the next best thing. And when it comes to vetiver, I agree with you. Vetiver is incredible. I think it's almost like a spiritual note. It's transcendental. It's got such a beautiful quality. When I wear vetiver, I feel connected to earth because of the earthy, the soil. I just love it. It's a very transcendental, spiritual, note for me. I also love lavender as well because I'm a big fougere guy. But green woody scents. So, I agree with that. Now, some more fun facts. What are the most expensive, raw materials and why? Give us maybe like the top three, like very expensive raw materials and why.
Okay, to my knowledge, I think currently of the raw materials really being used, the most expensive is the best qualities of wood. This can cost more than $50,000 a kilo.
Wow.
For pure oil. Of course, oud is very complicated because there's a lot of mixing, combination, adulteration, but the pure oil from Cambodia, from Bangladesh, from Assam can reach these levels. And it's worth it because you can use it at incredibly low dilutions and still have a super powerful effect. And when the balance in a oud oil between the woody note and the animalic facets is good and rich, it's matchless.
I agree.
Of course, then you have a lot of orris butter derivatives that can be extremely expensive. And then to give an idea maybe to our audience, rose oil is going to be in the range of $7,000, $8,000, and then you go down and you come to patchouli, you know, which is also extraordinary and absolutely a fantastic raw material, and there you get to $50, $60, you know. So the range is fabulous. The range of things that are used and are for sale. And honestly, and this is a personal thought, a lot of these ingredients are, to me, incredibly cheap. Frankincense is cheap. Patchouli is cheap. Lavender is cheap. Rosemary, super cheap. And we have to be very careful as an industry with that. Because if we want these products to continue to grow, to be abundant, that can be used in big volumes in aromatherapy and other things, then we have to make sure that the people at the origin can make a real good living cultivating and distilling them. And this thing around prices really is a very, very important topic.
I agree. And do you feel like the big companies, the big, Firmenich, Givaudan, Man, whatever the case may be, do you think they offer the proper structure and support to these distillery facilities, worldwide? Or do you still feel like these people are being taken advantage of and they still live in poor quality of life? And what is your feeling about that? Do you think, because what you've seen over the years, do you think it's still pertinent today, or do you think that has changed substantially?
Okay, clearly a lot has changed and usually and mostly has changed in a good way. Now there's two aspects to that. We come from a time 30, 40 years ago where the purchasers of these big names that you mentioned, they were staying in their offices in Europe or United States. They weren't moving. They were not interested. They had people that they sort of trusted at source. And I'm telling this famous story, goes back to the 70s in the book, where that ended with a major disaster of a full boat of patchouli drums, which happened when they got to New York to be water. And that was some kind of illustration of what is the cost and the risk of not taking the care of going yourself to see what's happening at the origin. So that has changed. All the guys in charge now, they go and visit. The second level is, with whom do I partner at source? Because it's like in many, many other areas, and it's logical. You find people, be it Paraguay, be it Bulgaria, some people are absolutely great and other much less. People don't have the same ethics, don't have the same level of transparency, don't care the same way about the farmers and the pickers. So I think progress also has been made by most of the companies to be much more picky about who are they going to work with. And today, selecting a partner at source is completely key, because this is the guy who is going to decide how much he pays a woman in India to pick her tuberose or a jasmine flowers. You know, it's just as simple as that. So it's not like, it's not the Givaudan or the feminist guy who decides how the lady should make. You have to have a partner at source who knows exactly what he's doing. And for a long time, the companies were buying from people. They were sitting in Jakarta or in Medan, and they were never going, to see what was happening with the guys who were, working like crazy to grow the patchouli leaves. So this has changed. It's changed in a good way. Progress has been made. Now, the difficulty is that at some point, and it's interesting, at some point, we're still a luxury industry meeting some of the poorest areas, as I mentioned, and the poorest trades of the earth, which is farmers, you know, the 700 million farmers in India doing their mint or their jasmine. So still, there is something that will remain difficult, you know, and a lot of people are challenging, saying, wow, this is, you know, this is horrible. The luxury should not be using da-da-da-da-da. I think we should see it a little bit more simple. I think the luxury industry has the power to bring a lot to these people at source. Bring a lot, you know. It's fantastic. I was mentioning the benzoin. Each time a company buys benzoin, they know it or not, but they do a great good to the farmers in northern Laos. If you buy pure vanilla beans instead of buying Chinese vanillin, you do a lot of good to the farmers in Madagascar, providing that you buy these beans from a person like my Gigi I was mentioning, who knows what she's doing and who is doing real good to the farmers.
Understood. So that's great knowledge right here. And still, you know, within this topic of current practices, you know, ethical, moral, there's a word that's been thrown around quite often over the last few years, which is sustainability. You know, when you look at the abundance of niche brands that are exploding almost every day, you know, how can you truly tell if they're using the best proper materials or not using, you know, horrible fillers, you know, adulterating the product? So how can the consumer educate themselves, you know, because there's no seal of or certificate of authenticity of I think there should be a little more control, you know, as opposed to so many brands, because at some point we're going to need to control, because I mean, obviously, if the brand don't have the quality, they're going to fail anyway. But you know, you with your experience, how can you tell if a company is following the right procedures, you know, the right steps, utilizing the proper products? They're talking about sustainability, but how can we, you know, prove that it is in fact, you know, sustainable and good source of products?
Very good question. Very important. Very difficult. To me, it's all about transparency. It remains the key word, because everything's difficult, you know. At the moment of deciding whether what I was taking the example of a woman picker of jasmine in India or the women who sort the frankincense in Somaliland, it's very hard for a Westerner to decide what is fair, what these people should earn, and because there's a lot involved in terms of traditions, in terms of the way things are organized in these countries. But what we cannot not look at is transparency, which means that even the final brand, the niche brands that you mentioned, should be able to tell their customers, well, listen, I'm launching this new perfume. I'm advertising that it smells patchouli, lavender, and Peru balsam. So the first thing they absolutely need to demonstrate is that, is it real natural patchouli? Is it lavender or is it linalool acetate? And is it real Peru balsam or substitutes? So that first level, as obvious as it may seem, is very recent that we progress on that. That's a first step of transparency. Then, okay, so your lavender, you should be able to tell me, does it come from France, Bulgaria, Australia? Tell me. And then you go step by step. Okay, if it comes from France, you sure it's lavender? It's not lavandin? Price is not the same. If it's lavender, is it wild lavender grown in altitude? Is it cultivated lavender? So and so on. And then you can go even to the last step, saying, do you know how many farms have contributed to this product? Have you selected them? Do you know where they are? With the final question that a customer will never ask, but which I'm asking constantly, take me there. Show me. Take me to these people. I want to see, you know. So, but I think the brands and the big companies have understood that now it's completely mandatory that they are able to answer all these sort of questions, you know. So sure. I think we're progressing. It's, as I said, it's complicated because someone will always step up saying, I'm sorry, but this lady in Madagascar doesn't earn enough from her vanilla. Okay, you may have a point, you know, that we could discuss and argue, but you may have a point because you always have points at the hour of deciding, you know, what should be earned in those poor countries by this very this very low level of earning communities. So anyway, I'm you know, what I discovered is that if you go where things happen and if you select ethical is maybe another key word, ethical, thus transparent people, then you've solved 70 or 80% of the problems.
I agree. And I also agree, Dominic, that I think as a whole community of fragrance lovers worldwide, we have made tremendous progress because of events, because of books such as your book. I think the knowledge has been shared quite strongly over the last decade. So people are more aware of what to do, what not to do, who to trust, who not to trust, without stepping on anyone's toes, you know, without talking about anything bad, but quite the contrary, giving credit where credit is due. Can you name maybe, you know, five companies that you truly respect? I'm talking about niche perfume brands that you truly respect for their practices and the kind of maybe that you know that they actually work with, sustainable sources, so forth and so on. Can you name maybe like three or five fragrance brands that you love and respect?
Well, I can only go for people that really I know and I've worked with, and that's nothing against the others, and I don't want to forget anyone. One that steps to mind is Le Labo, maybe, because I know exactly where they started, how they started, what they wanted, how they were going for superb qualities and the expense and effort they took to source each of their raw materials and to document it, which they did in a pretty a splendid way. So that's one for sure. The thing is that a lot of niche companies have their perfumes crafted by the perfumers who work for the big companies. So the position and the sourcing of the big companies is very, very important because, you know, if I'm Kilian or if I'm Tom Ford, my rose oil will be supplied by the perfumer who did. So I have to know if the guy works for Man or for Firmenich or for Givaudan, then who is he? And again, has the perfumer taken the trouble to make sure where is rose oil that he's using is coming from? So it's a combination. You cannot put all the responsibility on the final brand. The majors, the names we mentioned, the IFF, Firmenich, well, the big guy, Symrise, have a very heavy responsibilities because they're the one who construct the palette that the perfumers use.
Very true. Now, another big question and big topic of conversation, Dominic, is natural versus synthetics. So there are diehard people out there that will say that naturals are superb and far better than synthetics. Other people say you need synthetics to make a great product, you know, mixed in with naturals. What is your position on that? And it's a two-part question again. What is your position on natural versus synthetics? And what do you see as the future of perfumery? Because I talk to a lot of brands such as Givaudan, Firmenich, and they always have these new compounds that they're creating, these like preset compounds of new, you know, chemically, like all these chemical new compounds that they're creating that will give you some kind of experience, which is like a mix between a few things. It's even hard to fathom or to grasp because the possibilities are endless. But first, natural versus synthetics, and what do you feel will be the future of perfumery with a lot of the new chemical synthetic compounds being developed?
Okay, so I'm a naturals lover. I've dedicated my life to naturals. But the truth is, you talk with any good perfumer, and he will immediately tell you that if he wants to do a superb perfume, he absolutely needs to use both. Okay, synthetics are invaluable. They bring architecture. They bring a backbone. They bring a lot. They bring a lot. Think, you know, you can't escape that. The problem is that usually and mostly they are so much cheaper that the 70s and the 80s have found that it was pretty ridiculous, you know, insisting of putting rose oil where you could do elsewhere, because simply you would do, you know, strong products that would be much cheaper. And then that led us to realize that using less and less naturals was a true disaster for the quality of perfumes. So there's a balance to be found. And I think this is not really, it's no more a debate. Everybody knows that a perfume that will be well constructed with the right quantity of naturals, of true naturals, of quality naturals, will cost a lot. And that will reflect on the shelf. So, and that's where most of the niche brands come today, you know, assuring you that, but their perfumes are full of synthetics also. And all the ones who have tried to launch pure 100% naturals perfume, I can tell you they're really struggling. I can tell you they're really struggling. Because when you do that, you come to a point where then the next step could be to say, well, listen, I'm going to go to my aromatherapy store next door. I'm going to buy my 5, 6, 10 essential oils. I'm going to do my blend myself, and that's all I'm going to wear, you know, which is another thing, which is more about then your personal relationship with perfume, with scent, and also with nature, because you're perfectly legitimate if you want to say, I don't want to have any synthetic on my skin. Okay, but for what perfume has been through history, you need to repeat that a good perfume is a combination of synthetic and naturals. And again, naturals brings an incredible addition to the perfumes. It brings the subtlety. It brings the richness. It brings the faceting. It brings things that cannot be expressed. It's always the same example, but I think it's so important, you know, that rose oil contains more than 350 different molecules. If you want to do a chemical rose oil, you're going to put 5 or 10. So that will vaguely smell rose, but no perfumer will tell you this smells rose, you know. So, and on one side, you have something that costs $100 and on the other, 7,000. So you choose. But again, you know, good synthetics, super good, pure naturals. So,
go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, go on.
No, for the other part of your question, where are we going? And where the problem here is that the leaders of this market, so the five big guys and a few others, they're in constant competition to convince the brands that they bring something or they will bring something that the neighbor doesn't. So so there you are sort of between technical and marketing, okay? So very often they will claim that, for instance, they do a biotechnology, you know, and this is fantastic. Or they do... you know, that they only use for certain products the leftovers because this is better for the planet, or that the more they work, the more their synthetics are produced through green chemistry, which can be true. So each one is trying to promote his strong points. I think biotechnology basically today comes down to creating new so-called naturals from sugarcane. You know, you have sugarcane and then you have the enzyme and then. So I know very well the story of Firmenich and creating a bio technology patchouli, and when that was done, everybody thought, okay, patchouli is dead, that's it. And absolutely not. This does not happen. It created a new product which is a new patchouli, different from patchouli, and the conception of natural patchouli remained. So I think that's probably going to be, I think that the current palette of natural products is so rich, so important, so valuable that it will not reduce. It will be only pushed upwards in terms of quality, and the rest will be additions that, again, you know, will maybe help the launch of a certain perfume, certain other aspects.
I'm glad to hear that. Now, one last topic here that's a little bit controversial, but maybe you have a good grasp on it. You can shed some light on this topic, which is allergens and discontinuation of products. So a lot of times the big brands, like we talked about, will ban a certain product because of an ingredient that's in that perfume. For example, oak moss, which is one of my favorites, along with vetiver and lavender. Oak moss has been a big thing over the last few years. A lot of fragrances that contain real oak moss was banned because of allergens. Do you feel that this is just, you know, a way to make more profit for these companies, so they find these quote unquote synthetic ingredients that are more affordable, that way they can make more price per mil profit? Or do you find a valuable or a valid point on the discontinuation of these so-called allergen ingredients? What is your position on that?
I'm very very worried, to tell you the truth. I think I've witnessed a few of things that were banned over the years. You know, when I stepped into this industry, we were still extracting oak moss and others with what we call benzene. And a benzene is something different in English, but a benzene which has been replaced by hexane. This was a major progress, and we were right to do so, because benzene has clearly been identified as potentially carcinogenic. So a few things deserved to be limited or even banned. Now we've gotten to a point which is very different, and there's a big challenge in Europe, especially today, which is that the European authorities want to consider that an essential oil should not be tested as one, but should be asserted as what is the level of potential allergenic of each of its molecules or constituents. Wow. If you do that, you potentially declare that half or 70% of the current products used are dead. So, and why is this? I think it's because the public is more and more demanding that chemistry should be harmless. And all of this is considered as chemistry, you know. So on one side, you have these essential oils that some of them have been used for 1,000 years, forever. And then you got these people saying, this might be super dangerous. We'll have to limit this. And this is terrible. This is terrible. So a few of us in the industry, the IFIAT organization and others, people are really fighting very, very strong. And I think we have a major challenge. An essential oil should be tested. And when it is, they really come very well out of the testing as a one ingredient and not pieces of other ingredients. So, yes, there is a real threat there.
Understood. And last but not least, I wanted to talk about some untapped areas or materials. Do you feel, Dominic, with your experience and dozens of years in this industry, do you feel that there are still areas in the world, such as like the Amazon? I always feel like I always had this in the back of my mind that there's some kind of fruits or flowers or plants or something that we haven't discovered yet that could be so incredibly beautiful to utilize in the creation of the fragrances. How do you feel about that? And do you think that these areas will be explored, or you feel like, you know, companies have, you know, the palettes that they want and that's it, and there's nothing else to be added? What is your take on that?
Okay. Each perfumer will tell you, come on, I don't want to hear about the next rose oil campaign. Bring me something new. Dominique, go somewhere, bring me something new. They always say that. It's super difficult. A few things here. First of all, we sometimes do not realize the magnitude of the research and investigation that's already been done. From the 19th century, people have been everywhere, have distilled in the most incredible countries, the most. That's one thing. The other thing is, yes, and especially the Amazon, because it constantly come back saying, come on, you know, we can't continue having the three same old stuff from the Amazon, the rose oil, the tonka beans, and that's it. Come on, give me woods, give me flowers, give me fruits. It's very difficult. And maybe the greatest difficulty is once you find a superb flower on top of a 40 meters high tree, what do you do with it? You know, so actually the trend is probably to keep investigating, but to keep investigating with the capture, you know, the scent capture. You put a glass on the flower, and the scent goes and goes on a carbon cartridge, and then you analyze your cartridge in the lab and you reconstitute the smell. So you call it Headspace, you call it various different names. And I think regarding the flowers, especially of the Amazon and other countries, that's probably be more a source of invention than thinking of a very rare flower, because how are you going to take it? Where are you going to grow it? Does it cultivate in fields? You know, it's the availability. The availability is a challenge.
Understood. Listen, the conversation is amazing, Dominic. I can stay here for hours. You are literally an encyclopedia, a walking, living encyclopedia of compounds and materials. It was an extremely riveting conversation. I love it. If you guys want to learn more about, you know, the search of perfumes and compounds and materials, please do check out this book, In Search of Perfumes. I will have the link here on the podcast for you. I do highly recommend you check out. There's, you know, words of the trade. There is so much that you will learn with this book. And Dominic, he will be with us at Scent Explore this year in December. I'm going to be very pleased to see him again in person. I saw him in Oman last month. So Dominic, I want to thank you on behalf of the podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time for being here. You have any last words, anything you want to share with the listeners?
No, well, first of all, thank you very much, Max, for your invitation. I'm extremely grateful. It's always, I feel always so passionate and carried by the topics as they come. No, I think it's a fantastic world. I just encourage everyone, depending on its own taste or countries, the parts of the world that it prefers, to really investigate what's happening at source. Everything is happening at source. History started at source with the cedar of Lebanon and the frankincense in the Horn of Africa, and that's almost 5,000 years ago, and it hasn't stopped. It's just amazing when you sit and think about it, you know, the fact that we're still tapping the frankincense trees as they were doing at the time of the Queen of Saba and the King Solomon is just a dream. It's the story. It's our story of mankind. So keep your eyes and your hearts open, and thank you very much.
Some very wise words from Dominic Hawkes. Thank you so much for your time, everyone. We'll see you in the next one. In the meantime, keep smelling, keep making memories, and creating emotions. We'll see you right back here in another podcast episode very soon. Take care.